Welcome to the Floor Specifier Podcast. This is Brett Cyphers, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts and fellow members of the Specifier Editorial Board. First, we have Jeff Littlejohn. He's with the National Stormwater Trust, On-Site Performance, and he's also a senior advisor at the Adams & Reese Law Firm. Then we have Ryan Matthews. Ryan's a government affairs expert with the Gray Robinson Law Firm. And, of course, we have our editor-in-chief, Patrick Gillespie, who is also an advisor with the Adams & Reese Law Firm. I'm a senior advisor in the newly formed Aero Group, and I also host another podcast called Water for Fighting. Gentlemen, it's great to be with you today. How's the week been going so far? We just did the first week of session.
Yeah, what day is it?
Yeah, and we're recording this on a Friday, and if you had asked me yesterday or the day before, I wouldn't be sure what day it was. It is... And maybe ask you, because you're the most seasoned lobbyist veteran among us, Ryan, give a sense of what the first week of session is, and include Monday in that scenario.
Sure. Yeah, the normal cadence of the first week of legislative session changes session from session, unfortunately. And this session is a perfect example of that. So once the legislative session officially is underway, legislators can no longer accept political contributions. So the day before the legislative session, you can bet your bottom dollar, see what I did there?
I do.
That every member of the legislature will be here. Generally, Adams Street and the areas around the Capitol are quite a bit of a madhouse, because it is that last effort to have clients who are willing to give politically to make sure that those checks are in hand before session starts. And, you know, again, we have 6 to 7 interim committee weeks leading up to the start of a legislative session for a purpose in most years. And that purpose is to assimilate new members, freshmen of the legislature, to the process, to various executive agencies. Generally, we're pretty heavy with overviews and presentations for committees, so they understand that subject matter purview of their work that they're going to undertake. Now, the reason that this year was a little bit different is we had 3 special sessions and Snowmageddon in Tallahassee, which interrupted a lot of that initial work or elementary work that would be done. So we find ourselves here at the end of the first week of legislative session, and I have got significant anxiety with how far behind we are. Very few bills have had their first committee hearing. A plethora of bills received 4 committee references in the House, and normally that's a borderline kiss of death from a session when the timing is not what it is this year. Because, you know, for those who are not paying as close attention, most often than not, you have to go through 1 or 2 subcommittees during your process of moving forward in the House and Senate. Some of those subcommittees stop meeting week 4 of legislative session. So the time crunch really begins in earnest week 2 in a normal year, but you couple the additional special sessions we've had and the lack of work that was able to be accomplished during those interim committee weeks, and people are sweating already.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, and we talked a little bit about that before we started recording, was how many bills are filed in a given year during legislative session, and how many bills actually survive to make it to the governor's desk and for his signature. What was the number that you said? Something like 225, somewhere in that neighborhood?
Last year, I think we passed and the governor signed or acted upon 225 bills. I think at last check, we've got about 1,800 bills that have been filed this legislative session. And yeah, my statement before we hit the red button was, you know, what is the appropriate over-under line for this legislative session? My guess is that we pass fewer than 225 bills this session, probably somewhere in that 160, 165 range.
And I guess I'm not as good a judge of that as you are, but noticing some of the things when you look at appropriations requests from local communities, if I press refresh on my laptop right now, it will show me a new set of projects that are still coming out, even, you know, after all this time. The House, I mean, its deadline for that has long since passed. The Senate is still kind of trickling in. Is that the same thing with bills as well? How many more bills are we going to see that show into the system as filed or, you know, and or referred to committee after today.
So you shouldn't see any more bills pop out of bill filing unless they are a proposed committee bill, of which there are no deadlines for those to be filed. If a committee is sponsoring a bill, they don't have to abide by those normal deadlines. But the bill filing deadline, from a publication standpoint, actually was the first day of session. Now, you're right as it relates to appropriations. Some of those are still popping out. The House attestation form deadline actually is today. What are we, March 7th? Mm-hmm. So that, from an appropriation standpoint, you know, we'll see. But I will say that there are bills that have popped out of bill filing that have not yet been referred to committee. Mm-hmm. So see my earlier point about the sponsors and proponents of those bills sweating, because you don't even have committee references yet, and Monday is week two.
Yeah. And Patrick, you did a great job in this edition of the print and also online paper, the specifier, and giving some of those early bills to watch. Yeah, I think the one, and certainly people like me who, you know, who most of their history and experiences in water is, for the first time in a little while, we have a full-blown water management district bill. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. And just go back to that last point we were just talking about. As of right now, 2,600 appropriation requests on the House website.
Wow.
So it's, to Ryan's point as well, it's everything's crunched, and I think a lot of people aren't really sure how, even in the legislature, how all this is going to play out between all the delays and the political kind of kerfuffle and kind of where we currently stand. It's going to be interesting to see how they manage this right off the bat. But to your point, so we were able to kind of pull together, and there's a lot of bills, right? There's a lot of bills out there, a handful, I think five, that were sort of key bills that we think are going to get a lot of attention and have a lot of, you know, a lot of discussion. So kind of, I'll get back to the one you mentioned, but we have SB 80, which relates to state lands, SB 736, which relates to brownfields, HB 73, which is called the Safe Waterways Act, SB 374, which is a farm bill, which sort of relates to kind of farms and how they are classified and some of the kind of rural components that go into that. Mm-hmm. And then SB 7002, which came out from the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. And so that really deals specifically with water management districts, adds some new regulations to them, requires some reporting. I think it adds on some Everglades components. So it is going to be interesting to see what happens with that bill as that moves forward and what the legislature ultimately is trying to get out of that. Mm. If this is sort of a reining in of regulatory aspects, or if it's more information they're looking for. And, you know, obviously anytime you're dealing with those districts, which does have a history of kind of clashing sometimes with DEP in the past and certainly with certain key legislators, it'll be interesting to see where that ends up landing.
Yeah, I'm curious, from you, Jeff, and Ryan, you hosted a summit recently where the discussion was water management districts, transparency, accountability. I'm curious what your thoughts are. Jeff is our rivaled only by me as the most fiscally hawkish kind of guy. And so what's your take on 7002?
I think it's totally fair and probably overdue that the amount of money that is going into water management development projects is, you know, evaluated or really had a hard look, because there are so many millions and, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars that are going into, in particular, I'm not going to pick on the Everglades, but the Everglades is obviously the notable example. 800 million a year, like gigantic numbers. Mm-hmm. And you repeat that over and over and over again, and you do start to wonder, as a, you know, as a taxpayer, where's all that money going? How's it getting spent? You know, I know, and Drew Bartlett and his team, they're delivering tons and tons and tons of projects, and I know that that there's, you know, a lot of emphasis on that. But man, that seems like a lot of money, and I'm happy to see that there's some kind of more transparent reporting around that. I mean, I know that, you know, Drew and his team say, yeah, we do reporting every year. The legislature gets it every year. Maybe it's just it's too dense.
There's something to be said for that, and I think you're right. It's like, but in terms of the information being there, it seems like maybe there's more of a focus on what is the end of a thing. So if you're doing something like Indian River Lagoon restoration, Biscayne Bay, a BMAP, you know what the target is. Like, here's the TMDL. You have an idea. If you do these projects, you know what you get from them. And then at the end of that, presumably, you have done a thing. And so it seems like maybe that's the part that's a little opaque for these policymakers. And and appropriators. I'm curious what Ryan and you and Patrick think about that side of that.
So I think it's interesting in that the proposal is certainly creating a potential legislative versus executive conversation, because obviously DEP and the water management districts fall under the executive authority and office of the governor. And so having the legislature put into a policy proposal that they themselves would like to have a little bit more of a connection and or at least decision making over some of the dollars that the district are spending will certainly lead to a multi-branch of government conversation that will occur over the course of a session. And, you know, we did just see what was a disagreement over immigration and how that should be handled between the governor and the legislature. And while that is not a bad thing, and I think the speaker and the governor and the Senate president have all said they are on the same page on many, many things. Is this an instance where are they speaking from the same hymnal on this in particular? I don't know yet, but it will be interesting to see where the insertion of the governor's office and their thoughts on this too come.
Yeah, I think in you, Ryan, and I think even Patrick will have remembered some of these days. It used to be, at least when the first time I was in the governor's office and the second time, is that the review of water management districts, budgets, policy, that sort of thing, happen in the governor's office. They did the review. They took data from DEP on different aspects of what they were looking at, but it really was an internal review. And you're talking about literally two people. Plus, you get into the folks downstairs and that sort of thing. That kind of moved to DEP, but it didn't increase really the number of people that have the knowledge of how to go through five water management districts' budgets on their submittals on August 1st, which are significant. They're dense, and you can put really smart people, myself excluded, obviously, to look at that, and it's still tough to grapple with. And so I think we see this happen every, eight years or so, Ryan? I think the last time you were actually maybe even in charge of DEP in some of those moments when Governor Scott had relinquished some power to the legislature over the budget, then kind of pulled it back in because they kind of realized that once you let something go, it's hard to get it back. And it seems like maybe it's kind of cycling, but in a slightly different way this time, it appears.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not unique to this specific discussion of water management districts. I mean, the legislative process and policy in general has a very cyclical nature to, what is confronted by legislators in Tallahassee once a decade, and that spans all topics from voting rights to transportation to constitutional petition reform, et cetera. We've had, by and large, a lot of these conversations 1, 2, 3, 4 times in Tallahassee in the past.
Well, let's move on to the paper itself a little bit more. I mean, we talked about some of the things that are in there, and you'll see more of that certainly on the website for the specifier. But Patrick, talk a little bit about the paper itself and what people can look forward to in terms of the delivery of it this go around, because it's a little different than usual, right?
Yeah. So here we are on March 7th. This will be hitting mailboxes next week, so the week of the 10th. It'll be hand-delivered throughout the Capitol next week as well. So any legislators or staff listening will be able to see the print copy, and then we'll be publishing it online as well. So this edition, sort of the general mix of state agency water management district news, some of which I think once people see it will be very interested in some of the content, because they're always, as we just talked about, very interesting projects going on around the state. This one has a little bit more of a legislative flair to it just because of the season we're in. So a little bit about the governor's recommended budget, some, as I mentioned, the bills to watch, just a couple other things that are circulating out there in the political realm. So it'll be sort of your dose of things to watch as session moves on, and people should be able to go to floridaspecifier.com to see updates as bills move or die, and we'll be trying to keep people updated throughout the process.
Excellent. I think before we get into the favorite articles and things like that, we did also talk about something before we started recording, which was the different shape to what the environment was, metaphorically speaking, in Washington, D.C. We've had a kind of a flip-flop in staffing at both DEP as well as EPA, and that means that we get a colleague of Ryan's that is actually an old veteran of both the Army and of DEP, and John Truitt coming back in to fill in for Jess Kramer, who left EPA rather. Where do you think that puts us, Jeff? You're the most tapped into on the ground. What is it? What do rules, regulations, statutes mean to doing work? How does that look in your sense?
I love that John went back in. I think that's a great move for the department. Jess Kramer leaving and going to EPA has left a huge gap in that department. And John comes in knowing where everything is, how everything works. You know, he had that experience before. I'm thrilled to have him there. I think he's hitting the ground running already. So that's super good for the state. Appreciate, you know, John's willingness to go back in and do that. I'm super excited that Jess is up at EPA. She's the assistant administrator for the Office of Water, basically a direct report to the administrator. Senate, confirmed, position. That's a big role for her, and I know she's thrilled to have that opportunity to have a position like that. And that's really going to be great for Florida because she made great connections down here. She did a great job down here. She knows our issues and loves the state. And we're all looking forward to working with her on our issues, including, getting 404 back.
Right.
Having Truitt there, who is really the architect of getting the program in the first place, now back in that seat with Jess Kramer, who will be, kind of on the other side of the table negotiating the handoff back, couldn't be better for us.
Ryan, how do you feel about losing skill like Truitt's at Gray Robinson? I mean, I'm happy that he's back, instead of, a stranger, but I'm sure y'all are feeling a little bit of that loss.
Absolutely. John is extremely intelligent and well-versed in environmental matters. I mean, see Jeff's previous comment about being the architect to assume 404. He and I worked on that incredibly hard, and he carried that on when I left the department, too, because it was a 3 to 4 year effort. John is someone who service called to him, and he really, really enjoyed leading people at DEP, and he does a very good job at it. And I would say a glutton for punishment, because he previously served in that position for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And so if he can get almost a decade of being in that position, then kudos to him. He will always be a Gray Robinson alum, and we miss him already. But it was sort of to Jeff's point again, if you're going to lose someone like Jess Kramer, there was no better replacement than John Truitt.
Indeed. All right, Patrick, what do you like best in the paper?
Generally speaking, I like the fact that we had a really fun mix of articles. I think people from different areas, different geographical areas, different practice areas will get a lot out of what's in this paper, because I think it provided a good bit of variety. If I had to pick a favorite article, it would be the article on fluoride in water.
It is fun.
Generally speaking, people don't tend to say fluoride is a fun topic. I just thought, given the fact that it's a newsworthy current topic that people are discussing, a lot of cities and counties throughout Florida are trying to figure out what to do with this. I think a lot, obviously, is generated from all the things that RFK has said and how he plans on leading from Washington, D.C. And then you've got a handful of cities and counties that are taking action on this. Some that are not. Got the Attorney General himself from Florida, who is going around and testifying at a lot of these city council, county commission meetings. So there's obviously a lot of pressure to make a decision here. And we were able to capture some of the trends, which cities and counties are taking this action, who's not, who is. Department of Health actually has a tracker on their website of which water systems are adding fluoride to their systems. And so I think it's an interesting debate, timely, and we were able to provide a very Florida-specific aspect to that.
I'm curious, and I'm just trying to pull an opinion out of you guys, but is it something in terms of fluoride in water, is it something that, given the access to dental services now, is it just something that its value has passed? I mean, are we seeing the end of fluoride in water?
I think it's a fair question, but I do think that because of the overlap and or sort of parallel view of the new Trump administration and the state of Florida and certainly the legislature and the governor, quite frankly, there's going to be a lot of mirrored policies at the state and federal level. And that's not solely focused on fluoride, but all things. I mean, we've seen this legislature really embrace the Doge-style financial aspect of government as well. And I think that's only going to increase over the next year. So, I mean, whether it's fluoride or other RFK-type initiatives, I think you're going to see just the state and federal government in mere lockstep on a wide range of policy issues.
So now that we have you talking, why don't you keep on and tell us what your favorite article is, sir?
So I truly, this edition was excellent. There were a lot of articles in there that I could proclaim in Little John-like fashion were my favorite. I mean, 5, 6, 7 articles. I'm going to go ahead and just say the interview with Sean was my favorite. I think we all hold Sean in high esteem. Yeah. And so, you know, learning about his new venture with Dewberry and being able to move down to Tampa to be closer to extended family is great, and we're all happy for Sean. And I mean, he really just has a wealth of experience at the agency, so he'll carry that over to Dewberry and their clients well.
Yeah, and he just had a birthday, I think, about a week ago. So if you haven't, wish him a happy birthday, Mr. Little John.
I like that article too. It was nice to send Sean off with a send off like that. I also hold him in very high regard. I was happy that we could do that for him, and I am very, you know, very pleased to see him settled in at Dewberry, and I think that's a great fit for him, working with Cliff and some of his old buddies from the Panhandle. My favorite article this edition was the update on the federal, you know, what's going on federal environmentally. Trump administration is going to make a lot of changes, and I think, you know, there are a lot of sources for that information, but when it comes to bringing that back to Florida and kind of what it means for Florida, I want to keep the specifier really plugged into what's happening at the federal level. Was pleased to have an update this edition. You know, look for more. We do have some great sources up in D.C., and so my hope is to plug into those, tap those sources, and bring that information back to Florida so we know what's going on at the federal level.
Brett, what about you? What was your favorite this go-around?
Well, of course, selfishly, my favorite was one that I commissioned with somebody who's become a new friend of mine. And I apologize, Joe, if I butcher your last name. It's, I think, Joe Ballard with Mighty River Recovery. And he is from the St. John's River area. I believe he lives in Volusia County. But there are a lot of folks that are concerned with the overall health of the St. John's River. He is very passionate about it. Our conversations have been a lot of how do you focus energy? You see a lot of advocacy groups that do it the right way. And I would put the Nature Conservancy as probably the prime example of that. And then there are folks who I won't get into, but there are some folks that I don't think do environmental advocacy justice in a way that moves the needle to the goal. And I think Joe is somebody who understands that it's important what you do, but it's more important what comes out of the end, even if it doesn't look the way that we thought it was going to look at the beginning. And so I don't always agree with the conversation and the conversations that we have together, but I think it's important that we take some of those things into the specifier as well and be willing to discuss and debate those. And so for that, thank you, Joe, for providing that that op-ed for us.
Yeah, and just another shameless plug, because there's always one every time we do this, but we're always looking for different ideas and different thoughts, and for those who are listening, submit stuff. Submit it to us, patrick@floridaspecifier.com. Send us what you're seeing out there. Send us what you're hearing, what you see as good policy, bad policy. We like to have different ideas and make sure that people are able to see different perspectives on these things.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be perfect out there. Patrick is a master of the English language. He can help turn your thoughts into something that's a little more coherent than you might expect it to be. And so thanks for doing that, Patrick.
Of course.
Do we have any calendar stuff that we want to mention?
Yeah, usual assortment of upcoming conferences. And that's another thing for those who are listening. You know, as you have events coming up, please send those to us. We're only as good as the ones we know about or can find online. So please always send those along. We have a fun little conferences and events section where we like to make sure that those events are publicized, particularly some of the ones that you might not necessarily know about that are very industry specific. There's a lot of sort of offshoots of different groups that get together, and so we're always interested in making sure we publicize those. So do check those out on our website and in the print edition if you do receive it. Standard types of different conferences that are coming up.
Yeah, I think I want to, and it's not just them, but I'll mention them specifically. Jeff and Ryan with the Florida Environmental Network. You have these conferences coming up, and summer school is coming, and that's the summer, and it's July. But if your idea is to participate, not just in summer school, but participate in some of these other conferences that are out there. I just had a conversation with Pepperuccino about the Resiliency Conference, which is even later than that. But the time is to engage on these. So check out the paper. We'll try to make sure that we have that in there. But you're going to want to start having those conversations with Jeff and Ryan and the Peppers of the world to get involved, because they can be really valuable and you can be a part of that as well.
I think that about covers it. Thanks for listening to the Florida Specifier Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to hit subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen. And don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review. If you don't like what you hear, it's typically Brett's fault, so please be sure to let him know. But don't hold it against the rest of us. I recommend subscribing to the Florida Specifier online at floridaspecifier.com, and you can read your environmental news and commentary the new, old-fashioned way.
Production of this podcast is by Carl Sorn and David Barfield at Lonely Fox Studios, and we want to thank Bagels and Biscuits for letting us use their music for the podcast. Join us next time as we delve into the issues, policy, and people that environmental professionals and policymakers want to know about. For Jeff Littlejohn, Ryan Matthews, and the always terrible Brett Cyphers, I'm Patrick Gillespie, and we'll see you next time.